Madam President, distinguished delegates, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for the privilege of speaking to this General Assembly. Last week, America and the world marked the fifth anniversary of the attacks that filled another September morning with death and suffering. On that terrible day, extremists killed nearly 3,000 innocent people, including citizens of dozens of nations represented right here in this chamber. Since then, the enemies of humanity have continued their campaign of murder. Al-Qaeda and those inspired by its extremist ideology have attacked more than 24 nations. And recently, a different group of extremists deliberately provoked a terrible conflict in Lebanon. At the start of the 21st century, it is clear that the world is engaged in a great ideological struggle between extremists who use terror as a weapon to create fear and moderate people who work for peace. 5 years ago, I stood at this podium and called on the community of nations to defend civilization and build a more hopeful future. This is still the great challenge of our time. It is the calling of our generation. This morning, I want to speak about the more hopeful world that is within our reach, a world beyond terror, where ordinary men and women are free.
George, please shut the hell up. You have the nerve to yap about how so-called extremists killed 3,000 people on September 11th. Well, certain extremists did. It's not the one that's properly propagandized out. But what about the extremist institution that's plunging the planet into chaos? I'm not talking just about what's going on in Iraq. I'm talking about what's going on in the oceans, what's going on in the environment. Then you babble on about how these extremists are a threat to humanity. No. If you look what's going on in this privatized, globalized, monopolized world, you see what's really a threat. And it's what these thundering demons, these trolls are doing to humanity, makes it clear that the privatized order needs to dry out. You know what time it is. Slave time. Check it. Listening to 103.3, 101.1 with Skid in Santa Cruz, 104.1 Berkeley, 96.3 Asheville, 106.7 in the LA area, LUVER.com, the world, RadioFraud.net, the universe. Click into the slave website, go slaverevoltradio.blogspot.com, a couple of other slave and resistance sites, propagandapress.org and savagejustice.blogspot.com. Find out what time it really is. Tonight, we're going to deal with the war on the oceans. We got all that and a hell of a lot more on 103.3. Slave Revolt.
Everything you know is wrong.
Hello, seekers. Here we go again. And hello, especially to the skeptic inside you who might still believe.
Yeah.
ecological, sustainable biosphere is under imminent attack. Driven by the market forces of the capital world, the world's oceans find themselves overpolluted, overfished, and dramatically UV exposed. The sustainability of the oceans and the driving capitalist forces are in direct contradiction in this Ruins of Empire segment called The Dead Sea Scrolls, The Collapsing of the Planet's Oceans by Capital Monopolistic Privatized Forces. We're going to explore this crucial issue. So first, let's start off with David Helbar, author of the book 50 Ways to Save Our Oceans. And let's hear him talk about some of the dumping of the pollutants in the ocean, like mercury, by this machine of capital destruction. Check this out.
Mercury comes from, among other places, burning coal-fired power plants, which over half the energy generated in the U.S. is still coal-fired. It's not only the most carbon-intensive fossil fuel that's adding to global warming, that's damaging the oceans, but it emits mercury, which precipitates rain down into the ocean, gets absorbed up the food web, and eventually the top predators like swordfish and tuna consume it, and we ended up reabsorbing it in our tuna fish sandwiches. So, you know, there's this tremendous flux of pollution. There was this period in the United States in the 1970s after passage of the Clean Air Act where we really began to see our coastal oceans clean up as we reduced the point source of pollution from company pipelines and we built secondary sewage treatment. In the last 30 years, that's reversed. We've concentrated and industrialized agriculture. We have a lot of farm chemicals that the surplus washes down watersheds into, you know, Mississippi and the Gulf of Mexico. It creates, you know, where they grow. Just one example, in Iowa, we put 140 pounds of synthetic fertilizer for every acre of corn grown. And the surplus ends up growing a second crop of algae in the Gulf of Mexico. As that's fed on, like, little pinhead copepods, little critters, it drops in the water column. Microbes feed on it and suck all the dissolved oxygen out of the water, and that's what's called a dead zone. Anything that can't flee dies. Now, the most famous is in the Gulf of Mexico, which seasonally grows to the size of New Jersey. But in fact, the UN's identified 140 of these dead zones as a result of this agricultural and urban runoff around the world, one-third of them around the United States because of our greater chemical dependency in both agriculture and urban lifestyles, and also our tailpipe emissions. I mean, people don't think of this, but a lot of that nitrogen and phosphorus that is feeding these algal blooms, areas like Chesapeake Bay, 25% of that is nitrous oxide tailpipe emissions from increased traffic. As we build into the coastal zones, we create the traffic jams, we put people in harm's way, and we increase the runoff and the pollution, which we also do, of course, by building where we shouldn't build, on top of salt marshes and wetlands and on barrier islands, places that also provide the habitats that act as the nurseries and the filters of the sea. And when you take out these marshes, you're reducing the ability to restore the living ecosystems that we depend on.
So here you have a situation where the basic cooperative living energy resources and developments that are important for humanity to exist, with the realization that it must coexist with the eco-biosphere, is this completely being roughshod over because of the wheels, the engine, the whole structure and formation of how this society is set up, which is based off of a privatized capital model for privatized interests that generate its large, vast wealth off of the maximum exploitation of resources throughout the planet, whether we're talking human resources, slave labor, slavery period, child labor, or whether we're talking about the exploitation of forestry or other animal species on the ground, or animal species within the ocean. None of this means anything to these plunderers. And what's fascinating is that with all of the stuff that, you know, the whole power plants, and which is where still at this day and age, coal-fired power plant, 50% of American energy is being generated. Yet, as I've gone over before, there's been peer-reviewed scientific studies, like the one out of Stanford University by scientists, where not only America, but the Earth could generate enough electricity based off of the wind power technology that human beings possess right now. So we're not even talking futuristic talk. We're talking about what is available right now through human technology could provide for the available living energy system known as wind power. I'm not even talking about solar power, but wind power alone to generate enough electricity for human consumption. But there's a problem. And that problem is the controlling market forces that are already rooted and regimented in to a particular privatized vacuum. And anything that may challenge their dominance and leverage is seen as a threat and must be neutralized. That's the logic of the market forces in the planet today. And this is a consistent thing that we see taking place. So you have swordfish, tuna, all of these absorbing the mercury that's being highly, you know, produced into the biosphere. And rain brings it down, right down to the ocean. And what we end up having is a polluted biosphere for living creatures. And it just keeps on and on in this endless deadly cycle that is getting worse and worse. Now, speaking of swordfish, it's also been outlined and made clear that since the 1980s, commercial catch of swordfish has increased 8 times. So by 8 times, it's increased since the 1980s. Yet the weight of swordfish has dropped from an average of 115 pounds per catch to 60 pounds per catch. Now, in the early 60s, in the North Atlantic, the average catch of a swordfish was around 270 pounds. So what basically is happening, besides all of the polluting of the fish, is that with the massive grab of swordfish, the overfishing of these particular species, along with many others, you're having a collapse of the species, and they're grabbing them out younger and younger, and they're not being able to fully mature. so they're basically catching little pups. But, hey, this is the market force. And this is basically how the logic of the market forces play themselves out. And Carl Safina, who is a founder and director of the National Audubon Society's Living Oceans program, he outlines some of the things that swordfish have been going through along with other species when he stated that today, the submarine canyons and banks these animals prowl is so spaghettied with baited lines that more than 80% of the female swordfish caught are immature, killed before they can breed. Female swordfish take at least 5 years to reach sexual maturity, at which point they are almost 6 feet long. With long lines taking 98% of the swordfish catch, large adult fish are rare in the North Atlantic. Between the early 60s and today, the average size of the North Atlantic swordfish dropped two-thirds. In nursery grounds off Florida, off South Carolina, in the Gulf of Mexico, and elsewhere, long lines catch mostly juveniles. U.S. swordfishers in the Atlantic discard about 40% of the swordfish they kill. The fish are too small to sell. In 1996, they dumped 40,000. Dumped 40,000. So they catch these fish, they've overfished, now they've retarded the development of this particular species, and then they discard it like trash because these fish, because of their conduct, aren't allowed to reach maturity. That takes a very sick and disciplined mindset to proceed on in this type of path. And that same mentality that you see taking place against fish is the same type of structural mentality within the market order you see in these corporations and those people who adhere to this market system in the quest for dominance over oil, over water, and on down the long, dreary market force line. Now, Helvar also mentioned how, you know, the Clean Air Act of the 1970s was reversed, you know, over the last 30 years, and how synthetic fertilizer being used amongst just with highly powerful fertilizers that are now in play have helped create the dead zones in places like the Gulf of Mexico. And this is basically because of the nitrogen and the phosphorus. Now, you know, there's a dead zone in the Mississippi River that's over 7 miles long. And that's directly due to the toxic runoff. You know, you have about 30 states that are, you know, all around, all over the place, where at the end of the day, the runoff from the water reaches major arteries. And one of the major arteries in the region is, of course, the Mississippi. So it finds its way into Mississippi. So between the Cancer Alley, where you have all of these corporations just spewing their garbage right into the Mississippi, and the fertilizer runoff that comes from these different regions throughout the states, you have dead zones being developed in places like the Mississippi River and throughout the world for that matter. Now, what's also fascinating is that it's been found that a 14% cutback of nitrogen in the fertilizer would play a pivotal role in helping curtail some of the dead zone effects, the deadening effects into these rivers and into these oceans. Yet, getting states who are in cooperation and in allegiance with the whole apparatus of the corporations And the Fertilizer Corporation is one of the major lobbyist players into this whole dynamic. Basically is like throwing a penny to the moon under the particular market construct. So once again, just basic things that would help relieve rivers and oceans from the massive attack by the way the market system is set up and the corporations are set up and the state apparatuses are set up. They all go to no avail as long as you operate within this market order. Now, Daniel Wallace wrote an article October 19th, 2006, saying UN says number of ocean dead zones rising fast. And some of the article goes like this. He states that the number of dead zones in the world's oceans may have increased by two-thirds in just 2 years, threatening fish stocks and the people who depend on them. The UN Environmental Program said on Thursday, fertilizers, sewage, fossil fuel burning, and other pollutants have led to a doubling in the number of oxygen-deficient coastal areas every decade since the 1960s. Now experts estimate there are 200 so-called ocean dead zones compared with 150 2 years ago. Now, it goes on from there. But that just gives you an idea of the type of dynamic that human beings are finding themselves in as they push themselves towards the tipping zone day by day. Now, Helbar also mentioned the issue about how this whole on this whole privatized corporate construct, you had the building on marshlands and wetlands and all of that. And what's fascinating about that is that we've seen how this has played out in other slave episodes, like in Hurricane Sam 1, The Real Problem. When we went into with a documentary, City in a Bowl, how wetlands in the New Orleans area have been carved up by corporations just laying their pipes and everything else with no consideration about the long-standing health of the wetlands. Now, the wetlands serve as a buffer, a barrier in the inland dry islands from the effects of hurricanes and ocean winds. Yet, in regions around New Orleans where the wetlands have been savagely deteriorated because of the ramifications of the corporate construct, we've seen an intensification of these Hurricane Sam-like winds. See, these things that are happening are not just natural disasters or just natural occurrences. They are intensified by the object poverty of humanity, of the corporate structure that we live in. Now next, here Helbar goes into the plastics that are dumped in and find their way into the ocean. So let's check this out, did this.
And plastic may be one of the least talked about pollutants in the ocean in terms of its huge impact. Even an oil spill will, you know, natural petroleum will biodegrade, but the polymers of plastics, which have become so abundant, I mean, it's hard for people to remember. It's just World War II that we developed these miracle products, plastic to replace rubber and rayon to replace cotton. And they've become so ubiquitous now that everything's packed in plastic. All the plastic bags that get loose, I remember when a Walmart came to St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands. I used to go visit St. John, and within days of that Walmart opening, you saw these plastic bags floating in the channel between the islands. And of course, turtles think they're jellyfish and consume them. After Katrina, I was down on the coast there, and looking at the beach, miles of plastic in Biloxi, Mississippi. where you could see as the plastic was decaying from housing materials and styrofoam pellets. The birds were eating the pellets. So there's this first cycle that kills the wildlife. They literally starve. They consume so much plastic, there's no room left to feed. And even after it degrades, it never goes away. Plastic, the polymers, become this fine plastic dust that in parts of the mid-Pacific outweigh zooplankton 6 pounds to 1. That plastic is an incredible attractant of pollutants, of organic pollutants such as PCBs and dioxin. I mean, it's a contradictory term because there's nothing organic about these pollutants, but the plastic will concentrate them huge, 10,000, 100,000 million times more than seawater itself. And of course, that plastic dust becomes part of the food chain and concentrates the pollutants back to us. So you can't really throw plastic away. All you can do is create the circle of poison, and we're back at the top end of the food web.
So once again, you can see this cycle of death that's spiraling itself down into a black hole of capitalist oblivion and obliteration. Yet, there is no correcting market forces that have the answer, because the market forces are not driven by sustainability. Market forces are driven by the exploitation of the particular resources, of particular laborers, of particular material. So the technology that's developed is all engineered in a sense, in a form of aggressive extraction and exploitation. Whether we're talking about resources in the form of developments that and technology that end up used in the form of missiles, or in the form of plastics that in turn get turned into various ways of really not designed to help humanity, but the driving force is for those who are the captains of industry to better exploit what they want to do and conquer, either through consumer exploitation or through ocean resource exploitation. Now, as these things have developed, as Helvar was talking about, a lot since World War II, and you had the development of things like gill nets, and these nets are basically gigantic walls that are placed into the water. They're nettings that are looped around the heads and bodies of fish, and they are used at all levels of the ocean. The bottom surface, the mid-water surface, and on top, where they're in the form of drift nets. In the 1970s, Japan developed a monofilament fiber that was used to in a form of an open drift net. They're basically walls of death, as they've been called, super destructive. Now, these drift nets in this monofilament development are set with floats at the top and weighted at the bottom, and they're used in coastal waters and in the high seas. Some, if you take all of the combined nets that they have, it's about 40,000 miles. Now, dolphins are often caught in these monofilament nets because the sounds, the fibers and the thin strands don't reflect back the sound that the dolphins can pick up on. Well, at least. So they become a form of invisible walls of death, and they just get stuck in them, and they drown. Japan and Taiwan are legendary for the use of these particular types of nets. Now, you also, though, have these forms of strip mining of the seas. And there was a film out, a documentary film, in 1989 that dealt with how dolphins get caught in these nets of death. And between 315,000 to 1 million dolphins of all species are estimated to be killed per year, according to the FAO. Another 20,000 are killed through purse seine fishing techniques, like for tuna. Now, part of the reason why I mention this is that these dolphins aren't even the fish that they're even going after. They're primarily going after tuna. So this is a form of bycatch. In 1987, Japan's squid fleet had about 1,200 drift netters each, deploying about 30 miles of net a day for 7 months. Now, this is well over 7 million miles of net. I mean, this is... But this type of aggressive approach and attitude that even unwanted fish is acceptable, you know, it's this bycatch, it's waste. And you have a market system that's predicated that waste is acceptable. Whether we're talking about the waste of natural organic resources within the ocean, or the waste of humans that could be locked up in prison to maintain the market order, maintain the dominance and the security of the market order, or the waste of human beings in the form of their imperial wars. Those who strap on the boots for them, for empire, and those who are carpet bombed and caught in the drift net of imperial destruction in their wars in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and on and on. These types of waste of human life is parallel to the attitude of the rulers of the acceptable waste of life and resources throughout the ocean. Now next, let's hear how the destruction of the coral reefs is addressed by Helvar. Check this out.
You know, it's a crime and a tragedy. Anyone who's ever snorkeled or dove on reefs, I mean, when I was a kid, I'd look up at the stars and imagine that, you know, I was born a generation too soon to see alien worlds. First time I put on a faceplate and went into the Florida Keys, you know, I discovered alien life, you know, a vibrant world of color and exotic critters. And yet, within the last 40 years, the coral reefs of Florida have gone from 90% live coral cover to 10%. It's this incredible decline, and the reefs are the most diverse places on Earth, more so than rainforest. You have, you know, 25,000 species of fish and invertebrate, and the reefs themselves, the living polyps, are amazing critters that spawn on the first full moon in August off one reef off of Texas. You know, people come there to see these wonders, and they're going away. For a number of factors, you know, urban and agricultural runoff, where you see development put sediment in the water, agriculture puts various pesticides and chemicals in the water, and as spectacular as the reefs are, you can see the Great Barrier Reef in space. They have seven very unique conditions that are required for their growing. including water clarity, a low nutrient environment, a certain temperature range. The biggest threat, of course, is within that temperature range, there's growing warming of the oceans. And we've seen in instances like the El Nino of 1997 and 98, where for the first time we saw global coral bleaching. What happens is when the temperature may go from 82 to 84 degrees, the water temperature, that's enough to tip corals into a crisis. Most tropical corals, the polyps grab about 30% of their food in the passive water stream. The other 70% of the nutrients they get farming those infellar algae that live on them and give them their bright orange, brown, green colors. When the water temperature gets too warm, the algae becomes toxic to the coral. They expel it. They turn wedding cake white. And I've seen this in Florida and Fiji and Australia. And if the water stays too warm, the doldrums last, stays too hot for too long, the coral just die. And we've seen this die off most recently in the Caribbean this past summer and fall because of that hot pool of water that generated those huge hurricanes in the Gulf. Also bleached huge amounts of coral. They now think one-third of the Caribbean corals may have been killed. And as I say, when I was in, I wrote a book chapter just on this, on a book on climate change, and when I was visiting with the best coral scientist at the Australian Institute for Marine Science and at the Park Authority, they fear that even if we convert from fossil fuels tomorrow, we may have lost half the world's tropical reefs just to the heat we've already put in the system. That extra 1 degree warming we've seen in the last century and the additional 1 degree we've seen in the last 30 to 40 years. So it's a crisis, and what we really have to start thinking about is how to protect what we have left. And certainly one of the immediate issues is a change, a whole new energy regime that's not based on carbon.
So once again, we see that, when Hebhart talks about how we need a whole new energy regime that's not based on carbon, we need societies that are not based on the privatized market forces that exploit resources in the privatized model like carbon. Because other than that, it's an endless cycle of energy conflict, resource conflict. See, in reality, that puts us in conflict with these energy resource capitalists because they make profit off of the super exploitation of resources, off of energy. This is not any kind of sustainable cooperation that they are engaged in. It's all about the super exploitation for their market expansion based in their market principles. So they make, for them, within their structures of the market order, they make profit off of being resource capitalists. They make profit off of being disaster capitalists and arms capitalists, even though all of those things are in contradiction to a sustainable, habitable, at least for humans, Earth. Now, when Helbar also mentioned how there's a warming of the ocean. And, all the oceans are interconnected. And their flow, amongst other things, affects the environment. About 77% of the Earth is covered by ocean. Most of the living species are in the ocean. You know, the average depth of the ocean is around 1.5 to 2 miles. And there's living forms in all of those areas. There is not that same type of density of life on dry land. Now, with the increased temperature that we see taking place of the oceans, this temperature increase affects the salinity of the oceans. And we've seen the melting of ice water being dumped into the sea. And this dumping of fresh water into the ocean changes the chemistry because it becomes less salty. And as the chemistry of the ocean changes, the conveyor belts of the ocean are already have been documented as going through changes, slowing down. Now, the change of the ocean's conveyor belts is a change of the ocean's currents, and this affects directly the climate because of the changing of the acidity of the ocean. So all of these things change the dynamics of, and will have a change on the dynamics, not just within the ocean, but up here on dry land. Now, on the ocean, the change of the acidity, the chemistry, affects the development of animal shell life and bone growth in the fish species and the animal species within the ocean. But these other elements that are taking place have incredible ramifications for the sustainability of our types of species in the planet. In other words, what I'm saying is that the attack that is taking place by these market dogs, these trolls on the ocean, is not something that is going to quote-unquote kill the ocean, but it will kill the ocean in the sense of the ocean, which is the life giver to humanity, being sustainable for us. So the ocean will keep going, but you can create a situation on the planet where it just won't be sustainable for human beings and many other species. But for the market order, that's just something that they'll try to deal with. At least if there's a price to it. Now here, Helbar deals with the overfishing of marine wildlife in the ocean. So let's see what he has to say about this. Check this.
It's really the last great hunter-gatherer activity, because you harvest what you plant, but we're really just taking out marine wildlife at a rate faster than it can reproduce. I think that what happened is we took the military technologies that we developed in World War II, including Lorance, radar, sonar, plastic netting, tougher diesel engines, and steel hulls, and there used to be natural refuges for fish, which were called too far and too deep. Now we're able to go anywhere and track these species by satellite. And as we've depleted, we've serially depleted different species of edible fish, we've gone into the deep oceans, and we've gone into the southern ocean around Antarctica. It's unfortunate that there really is this unquenchable demand for the global seafood market that not only has led to the studies have indicated that within 15 years of discovering or choosing to exploit a new marine resource, 90% of that biomass is gone. And then we start regulating on the last 10% and act like that's the standard we should protect. The result is very scary. Rand Myers, a top fisheries scientist from Canada, put out a report in Science magazine a few years ago suggesting that 90% of the large predator fish are gone from the world's oceans in 1950. We know how to do it. We stop killing fish. We don't take more of the biomass than the species. You know, don't catch fish faster than they can reproduce. that's a lesson, but it's a lesson not learned. There's a lot of incentive in the global market. There's a lot of incentive in the built-in conflict of interest in how we manage fisheries in this nation. And it's a crisis. I mean, we talk about extinction on the land, but the best estimates are that marine extinction is taking place at 5 times the rate at which we're depleting the land. We do bottom trawling in an area the size of the United States every 6 months, in which you take these heavy drag trawls and with metal kind of slabs attached to them, and you drag it across the bottom, across the complex habitats of deep sea coral sponges and coral bottoms, and you just leave a rubble behind. And it's a tragedy. People are beginning to, you know, we're discovering new species of life, and we're just beginning to map this wilderness. At the same time, we're destroying it. And it's very reminiscent of our last great wilderness frontier. The question is, do we learn the lessons of the buffalo hunts, and do we learn to harvest, to hunt with restraint?
So the reality is that the buffalo hunt was an intentional buffalo slaughter to basically discipline, reduce, contain, and ultimately destroy the Indians. Because it became clear that in the plains area, that was the main source of food for the Indians. So if you destroy the buffalo, you are more or less solving the quote-unquote Indian problem. So the buffaloes became simply, within the expansion of empire, a casualty of war. And that's what we're in. That's what this market system is about. A perpetual war in all of its forms. As commented on, you have bottom trolling 5 times in the U.S. and it takes place every 6 months. Well, this bottom trolling, where they're just dragging their trolls on the bottom of the floor bed, this raking and ravishing anything up. Of course, this is going to destroy not only the fish or the particular species, shrimp or whatever, that they're quote-unquote going after, but the whole biosphere, because it's disrupting everything. But in the name of the war on the fish, within the market system, collateral damage is this a part of the structure. In the same way that in the name of a war on terrorism, the Fallujah bombings with white phosphorus, the collateral damage, the carpet bombing of Iraq in its shock and awe barbarity is not that much different than the shock and awe attacks that we see taking place in the ocean, all in the name of further exploitation and dominance by the market engineers. That's their mentality. That's their conduct. That's their particular way of life. Now, Helvar also talked about how there's no more natural refugees for fish. You know, you got satellite tracking, and so, and it's also a thing where it's yearly now. You know, where before, when technology of humans was not as advanced, it had more of a seasonal type of you know, fishing formation. But now there's no crab left unturned. So they track down these fish in the same way that they're tracking human beings in creating these ID programs for the further emasculation and control. We're no more human to these barbarians in this society than these fish are. And the same mentality goes within it, within the market forces. Now, he also mentioned how within 15 years of humans targeting a certain species, 90% of that population is gone. Now that's just astronomical. That just shows you the ruthlessness and the unsustainability of how this market force works. This is not sustainable in any way. Only propaganda has people believing that one can go on like this from time immemorial. Now, what's also fascinating is that the logic of the market system is so barbaric that this is how things play out, like with tuna that have found themselves vastly hunted. In an AP article in about what was going on in Tokyo, it had this. Tokyo, January 5th, 2001. An enormous bluefin tuna, a fish prized as sushi, sold for a record $173,600 Friday in the first auction of the year at Tokyo's main fish market. At $391 a pound, the 441-pound fish was the most expensive auction off at the Suzuki Central Fish Market in years. In 1996, a 250-pound bluefin fetched $44,100. Called Hanoguyo in Japanese, bluefin tuna is popularly served raw as sashimi or sushi in restaurants where a plate of slices can command a bill of more than $100. Both fish were caught in the Pacific Ocean off of Aomori Perfica in northern Japan, an area known for the quality of its tuna. Quote, "It's kind of like a brand name," unquote, market official Tazaki Yoshida said. Now, part of the reason why I read that little AP clip was that of course, we don't, as slaves, expect them to show the out-and-out insanity to all of this. But there is a logic to this madness. The reason why these fish are becoming more expensive is because they are becoming more rare. And as they become more rare for the capitalists and marketeers, that means that they are more prized possession to go after more ruthlessly. Even though, in the long term, and maybe more shorter than we think, they're going to annihilate this particular fish, which is how many of them make part of their livelihood out of. So they're destroying their own particular livelihood for the short-term gluttonous market principles that they are thrived in. But see, that's the logic of the market forces. Even though it's destroying and devouring its own future, it can't get beyond its short-term goals of constant profit over species, over resources, over humanity. There is no sustainability program, cooperative a program based within this market order. In the same way that human beings find themselves in places like Iraq, in the Middle East, and soon to be in parts of Africa, as we see what's taking place in South America under attack as these energy resource capitalists blaze their way to control the finite resources of hydrocarbons. And as hydrocarbons become more scarce, at least the easily refinable one, the intensification of the attack increases. That's the logic of the market order. War and more war of all kinds. Now, on this issue of what is now also taking place with tuna in the war on the tuna, you have what's called post-harvesting. This little catch-all phrase, you know how these guys, they never quit. Now, this is basically catching tuna in the wild, yet keeping them in pens before killing them. So basically, they're hunted down tuna, and then you basically enslave them in in pens, and then send them off to, you know, places like Spain and Italy and Croatia and all of that. And those areas account for 11,000 tons of tuna caught in the year of 2001. Now, that's compared to 24,000 tons caught throughout the Mediterranean region, the same region, through direct fishing. So what is happening is not that they're not intensifying the fishing anymore. It's just that you're seeing the collapse of this particular species, as we've gone over with swordfish and so on and so forth. So, but this post-harvesting trick has even made the whole bluefin issue even more dire, because you have the fish that, and I'm talking about overall, ecologically and stuff, not just for that particular fish, because bluefins, you know, like salmon and a number of other fish, swordfish, they eat other fish. So these fish have to be fed other fish. So the same people that have basically emasculated and evaporated bluefins and others in large numbers, now they have to go out, these same characters, with their same market principles, and catch the fish that bluefin eat, while these fish are being held up in their pens, being, you know, waiting for extermination. Only compounding the problems, because they use the same procedures that they gallop after these other fish for. But under this collapsing of the bluefin, you have all these different countries throughout the Mediterranean moving towards this whole post-harvesting fish framework. So you just have the continuation and the compounding of the dire effects of how these market forces work when they are at play for resources throughout the planet. And it's just a continuous diabolical thing that we see take place time and time again. Now, you also have Sergi Tadia. He's with the World Wildlife Federation. And he summed up some of the things concerning the tuna situation like this. Quote, "In sum, all the usual ingredients are there in the case of tuna fattening farms. Privatization of a common good. In this case, with the added risk of its probable destruction in the short to medium term. Concentration of the benefits in a few hands. Public aid provided to pillage a natural resource. Dispossession of the traditional resource users. Social and economic destruction of the traditional fishing sectors. Complete lack of regulatory framework. Conveyance of the administration. Ineffectiveness of international supranational organizations and growing demand for the product from a powerful market. So here you see how the market forces keep compounding the disaster and destruction in all forms, because the market forces are part of the problem of humanity. And in the same way that you're basically voting for one form of pollution or one form of executioner or another, Democrat or Republican, if you think that they in any way are a solution to the destruction of what we see taking place in the arenas of war by the market capitalist forces any and everywhere throughout the world, is the same type of illusion that you have if you think that these same institutions or those who are administrators for these institutions are a solution to the devastation that we see taking place in the world's oceans. Now, this whole post-harvesting, when they're putting these tunas in little pens, this has had disastrous effects for a number of tunas, just by the way the whole industry is set up. Kiwi White, a pilot for South Australia's Tuna Association, talked about this 1996 situation that happened. States that, quote, "The whole tuna industry now concentrates on catching fresh fish in the wild using purse sinners, transferring the live fish to huge floating cages, and then towing these cages up with up to 100 tons of live fish hundreds of miles back to our home port. There are many problems with bad weather smashing the cages and huge tides that slow the towing boats down to less than a knot. And it is not uncommon for boats to be actually going backwards. The fish are fed twice a day on sardines, and each cage requires three or four divers to clean out the dead fish, repair any holes, etc. The tuna boat operators now have a supply of fat, healthy tuna in the bay, so when the fish are needed in Japan, a team is sent out to harvest, kill, and prepare these fish ready to be air freighted. These fish command huge prices, and they have been the savior of the fishing industry in Port Lincoln. Many are now employed, and the owners are building huge mansions. Driving the latest Mercedes, and in general, spending large amounts around town. But the problem is, let me stop right there. The problem is, it's not sustainable. And the whole fact that the tuna continues to collapse. And the only reason why these plunders are going after the last ones is because they, by de facto, become, quote unquote, worth more. So the fact that there's more profit or a sustainable, quote unquote, profit within the market order, at least temporarily, has nothing to do with the sustainability of the way this market-driven system operates with the species in the water or out of the water. It has to do with the barbarity and logic of the market system that perpetuates this type of charade. So these are the things that we keep seeing become intensified in this conquest by the order with their market principles throughout the planet. Now, to outline how diabolical a lot of this, it's basically a sham. You know, the way they set up even their forms of regulation, it's all smoke and mirrors. You have like what's called the NOAA Fisheries Service, and basically that's 8 regional councils set up to serve basically corporate industries interests in a similar way that they have the FDA that's supposed to serve the interest and the well health interest of the masses for products that are put out, you know, whether we're talking about food, what's in the food, or medicine. But we know how that's all a sham, or the FCC, and how you have a revolving door, corporate door, within those apparatus that serve the elite interests. For the whole fishery service with its 8 regional councils is basically the same. You have appointees within these 8 regional councils from both the public and private sectors that outline all aspects of regional fishing. But most of these are filled with industry insiders. In other words, people in the fishing business who are given the power to help regulate fishing. They are boat owners, seafood processors, commercial fishermen, and a whole array of people with economic interest in the field of warfare fishing. Now, of New England's 12 members in their particular regional council, 8 are from the commercial field, 3 are in recreational fishing, and 1 is from an environmental organization. And that person who's in the environmental organization is the only one only person from an environmental organization in any of the 8 regional councils, which sets up the whole framework of how the U.S. sets up its whole fishing standard and guidelines. Now, the councils are exempt from governmental conflict of interest standards. Now, let's take the Gulf of Mexico's council. Now, this is, you had James Finsome. He was a Florida appointee attorney and recreational fisherman. After he served 2 terms, he declined a 3rd term, and this is what he wrote to Boy George's brother, Jeb Bush, you know, the governor, about the next appointee. Finsome said this, quote, that the next appointee should, quote, not be in a leadership position in any fishing organization, should not be a commercial or recreational fisherman who generates money by harvesting fish, should not be an immediate family member of a scientist who receives grants from the National Marine Fisheries Service. There has never been a member who has declared a conflict of interest on an issue and declined to vote. He also said this about the whole financial state, that it strains all logic and applicable science in an effort to maintain current limits. So basically what he's saying is that science is warped to maintain the interest of the commercial privatized insiders who dominate this whole setup. So the whole thing is a fraud. Yeah, and as I said, he stated the bit about there's never been a member who's declared a conflict of interest on an issue but has declined to vote. So even though when they admit they have a conflict of interest, they still get the vote. The whole thing's a farce. But that's because the whole thing is predicated off of maintaining the dominance and the interest of the market forces. So the hell with whether or not it's sustainable. That's the whole logic of this whole market order. Now, another council is the Western Pacific Council. And they're voting a record of two characters. One is Sean Martin and the other is Jim Cook. Now, they both operate a commercial supply gear and fishermen to fishermen in Honolulu. Yet, Martin moved to open up a turtle reserve area to longline fishing, even though longline fishing dangerously threatens four species of the endangered sea turtles. The motion was passed. So this is the type of characters you have sitting on these councils, who are, once again, part of the privatized commercial, in this case, they're commercial supply gear operators to fishermen. Now, Cook, his partner, has been fined for the illegal harvesting of lobsters, and Cook and Martin's company, Pacific Ocean Producers, have been fined for fishing illegally in protected waters, amongst other violations. So here these guys are just criminals. Yet they sit on these councils that are supposed to be the guideline in maintenance. Well, they are the guidelines in maintenance and gatekeepers. But once again, who are they gatekeeping for? And is this sustainable? Now, in March of 2005, at one of these NOAA conferences, you had this Vice Admiral Conrad Lautenbrat Jr., this character who's the Undersecretary of Commerce for Oceans and Atmosphere. This is the position he has. Yet, this is what he says, quote, "I don't believe in the great conflict of interest issue. I don't think we have that on our fishery management councils. It's not a problem anyway." So here I just outline just a small element of the contradictions and the dynamics that take place within these little councils. Yet you get clowns like these guys basically giving the nod of approval and trying to substantiate the whole construct of this market system within the fishery business. Now, Josh Eagle, who's an attorney for Stanford Fisheries Policies Project, he mentioned this about this whole fishery management council thing. Quote, "The councils decide how many fish can be caught and who can catch them. Because larger catches are easier to divide up amongst competing fishery interests, the council's responsibility to allocate catches encourages them to set lax fishery limits, undermining conservation," unquote. So once again, the whole thing is not sustainable. But see, when the slaves think about or hear them talk about something being sustainable or what's sustainable to them, the only thing that they care about being sustainable are their particular interests, their domination. And those who adhere to that order or who are administrators to that order, Democrats, Republicans, follow those same guidelines. Now, they may try some smoke and mirror games, but at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. Now, here, Kelvars talked about how temperature change in the ocean is changing also the fish habitat. So let's check this out. Dig this.
Seeing dramatic changes in temperature regimes. My friend found a green sea turtle, a tropical turtle, hauled up in Stinson Beach, where I used to live in Northern California. They were also catching barracuda. The salmon populations in Alaska, wild salmon populations are collapsing in certain river basins. And when I was down in Antarctica, I mean, I was at Palmer Station. The chief scientist there, Bill Fraser, said that when he was a student, a graduate student, his professor said, climate change is real, but you'll never see it in your lifetime. He says in the last 20 years, he's seen, you know, glaciers in retreat and landscape ecology altered and species like the Adelie penguins collapsing because the increasing warming there means more precipitation in the form of snow. The snow buries their traditional breeding grounds, but because they're hardwired, they try and nest in the snow and none of the eggs are productive. And we're seeing this shift in endemic species being really hammered, species that are dependent on unique ecosystems like coral reefs or polar ice are being tremendously impacted by this change, but so are we all. I mean, the hurricane seasons we're seeing here, the historic flooding in the Danube right now, Hawaii is going through the wettest, and California, the wettest seasons they've seen in decades. It's a dramatic shift, and I think one of the scary things that people are seeing is a slowing down of the conveyor belt that brings the warm Gulf water into the North Atlantic. There's been a 30% slowing in the deep end of this conveyor belt just since 1970. In geologic times, this has happened before, and when it has, when the conveyor belt stops and the Gulf Stream stops going north, you see New England and Northern Europe thrown into a new ice age. And, you know, so it's very scary. We know what we need to do, but what we need to do also is to form what I call a blue movement or seaweed. You know, we need to form the bottom-up demand from the public to make the changes that are needed.
So once again, we see the dynamics of doom that this whole market order is plunging the planet into, at least a planet that will be sustainable to humans and a number of other species. Now, another thing that happens, you know, with all of this melting, you know, with the rise in temperatures of the ocean, the melting of polar ice caps, many of these polar ice caps contain things like methane. So the release of methane compounds the issue of the warming up of the planet. So you're just starting to have a thing where things are just spinning and spinning and spinning out of control, because you're more or less letting the capitalist genie bottle of doom out of the bottle for so long that that's where the tipping point that many people have talked, or scientists are often talking about, is starting to draw nearer and nearer. But once again, within the market system, that's all part of the course. In the same way that what they call bycatch, basically this killing fish that they're not even going for, this part becomes part of the collateral damage of the market order. They got 11,000 miles of, you know, hooks and nets and stuff. And it's been estimated that 25% of the fish that they catch are the quote-unquote wrong fish, which amounts to around 88 billion pounds of quote-unquote the wrong fish. But that's the price when you're a market engineer and you want to minimize the cost of what you're doing. So they're throwing out miles and miles of drift nets and catching any and everything, and then they're just, you know, tossed back in dead. But they don't matter to you, because to spend more money specifically going after a particular species would not be cost incentive within these market principles. So just the logic of the whole market system in all of its detail helps outline the contradiction of a sustainable planet as long as these engineers are in charge. Now last, let's check out what Helvarch outlines about the importance of the world's oceans and waters that it has for Earth's species' basic existence. So let's check this out.
Simply, it's when NASA sends shuttles off to explore other planets, the first thing they look for is water. And 98% of the water on this planet is salt water. It's the source of life on the planet. It's the driver of climate and weather. We talk about the rainforest being the lungs of the Earth, but it's actually phytoplankton in the ocean that absorbs some 2.5 billion tons of carbon every year, giving us the oxygen back we need to breathe. As I say, creating the rain patterns. Liquid is in, you know, it goes from the ocean. It you know, evaporates, it becomes clouds, it rains out in our mountains, follows gravity down through the watersheds, out through our estuaries and salt marshes, and through the seagrass meadows and beyond the barrier islands into the crusty mounts, into marine canyons, back to the bottom of the ocean, and begins this circulation again that really feeds the circle of life. I mean, it's 70%, 17% of the human protein we consume. It's 98% of the trade, the non-NAFTA trade in this country, is seaborne commerce. As I say, the rain, you know, feeds the fields that grow the crops. We're all incredibly, you know, wherever we are, the oxygen we breathe, we're dependent on this. And I think people feel that connection. The planet's surface, at least 71% ocean. We're 70% water in our bodies, and our salts exactly as salty as the ocean was at the time we emerged from it. So I think this total dependence is for many of us a felt connection. I mean, when I lived on a cliff above the ocean in San Diego, the waves would beat, and I never slept better in my life. It's like your mother's heartbeat.
But the heartbeat of the market order is basically the beating drum of war. Whether we're talking on human beings within this country, human beings on the other side of the world, or species of all sorts on land or within the world's oceans, the market order and principles of war domination are the same. Jonathan Stein, in April of 2006, wrote a thing called Enemies of the Oceans. And he outlines some of the characters that are involved in traditional market principles in their war on the ocean. One of it says, quote, Japan offers multi-million dollar grants to poor countries in exchange for pro-whaling votes on the International Whaling Commission. In a famous example, both St. Lucia and St. Vincent and the Grenadines changed their anti-whaling positions 2 weeks after their prime ministers took trips to Tokyo. The two countries then received $20 million in aid from Japan. Gortons. Generations of U.S. consumers have been told to trust the Gorton fishermen, but its Japanese parent company, Nippon Sushi Kasha, has killed some 2,700 whales under the guise of scientific research, quote-unquote. Since buying Gorton's in 2001, McDonald's gets its filet of fish from Gorton's. The FDA. Toxic PCBs are regulated by the FDA in commercially sold fish, while the EPA issues consumption guidelines for fish caught recreationally. Using standards set in 1984, the FDA allows such high levels of cancer-causing PCBs in farmed salmon that, according to an environmental working group study, Were they present in wild salmon, the EPA would restrict the consumption to one meal per month. Europe. Since Europe's waters are running out of fish, fishermen subsidized by the European Union to the tune of $350 million in 2001 have headed towards West Africa, where fish stocks have fallen 50% in the past 20 years. The rarity of fish in West Africa contributes to the bushmeat trade, meaning that leopards, monkeys, hippos, and antelope are paying the price of EU overfishing. This is the destructive logic of the market order. War of all kinds. War against all forms of species. War that knows no bounds. Well, it's time that the slaves put a drift net on these market trolls who troll the world with their nets of death against humanity. Hold on a sec.
It has been estimated, though, that now if we're talking about animal species, including everything from insects and bacteria all the way up to things the size of whales, that we're losing several thousand every day. Now that includes microbes and insects that probably haven't been discovered yet. But we are in what many people call the sixth great extinction. We're losing a lot of species now as we speak. There is far more life and far many more species of life in the ocean than on land. First of all, the ocean, if we're talking about the world ocean, is the largest habitat on Earth. Two-thirds of the planet, as everybody knows, is covered with water, and most of that water is over 2 miles deep. So the predominant habitat on planet Earth is deep ocean. One of the problems is overfishing. Now, there certainly are, as the saying goes, lots of fish in the sea, but what's happening is poorly conceived programs, that is, poorly conceived in retrospect. When they were thought of the first time, that seemed like a good idea, for example, to catch as many of a given kind of fish as you could. You could tailor your fishing operations to catching this kind of fish. You knew where they were, you kept catching them, you kept selling them, and your descendants kept being in the fishing business. That is the definition, if you will, of the cod fishery. It was discovered in North America by the earliest settlers who came to North America. In fact, the Basques, who came here in the 16th century, they landed at a place called Red Bay, Labrador. They started whaling there, and they also started fishing for codfish. Codfish were enormously plentiful in the North Atlantic in the 16th century, so much so that an entire economy, the economy of New England, that is maritime New England, was based on the codfish. There's a codfish now hanging in the State House in Boston, Massachusetts, as the symbol of the economy of Massachusetts. So any maritime state that had a fishing industry in New England depended almost entirely on the codfish. And this went on from the 16th century, the 17th century, the 18th century, well into the 19th century. And the codfish sustained the economy not only of New England, but of maritime Canada, of Newfoundland and Nova Scotia. That's what they fished for. That's what Captain's Courageous was all about, was the cod fishery. Then people began to notice, curiously, that the codfish they were catching were becoming smaller. In other words, when a large codfish in the 18th and early 19th century could be 5 feet long, now the largest ones they were catching were 2.5, 3 feet long, and then over time they even got smaller. What happened was that scientists began to look at this, and they began to say, hey, wait a minute, something is going wrong here in this fishery. We ought to be getting large fish still, but we're not. We're getting smaller ones. What does that mean? It means that we're catching fish before they have a chance to reproduce. And if that happens, you're looking at a recipe for a population crash. If you catch fish that haven't reproduced, and you catch a lot of them, then the population cannot reproduce and crashes. That's exactly what happened. They fished out the codfish. Now, this sounds like, you know, in fishing, you think, oh, well, there's always a big place, that ocean. You just told us how big it was, how much water there is. We'll find some other fish to fish for, and then we'll catch them. And when they run out, well, we'll find some other fish, or we'll go somewhere else to find codfish. What happened is they fished out all the codfish, and they fished them out to the extent that the cod fishery, the industry, was shut down by the United States government and the Canadian government permanently. That they're not shutting it down thinking, well, if we give them a couple of years, the codfish will come back. What they're doing is they're recognizing that overfishing to that extent has destroyed the codfish population. Because what happens is if you take a population of creatures from their environment, take most of them out, you don't end up with a kind of codfish population-sized hole waiting for codfish to come back. Something else fills that hole. And in this case, it's the creatures further down the scale. So the fishes that the codfish used to feed on proliferate. They then become the dominant predators. Codfish are the predominant predators in their ecosystem. That's something of the herring. Let's say they feed on herring or squid. Now the squid and the herring become the predominant animal. And when the little codfish are born, it's assuming there are still codfish to be born, the squid and the herring eat them. They don't come back. So what you've got there is the destruction of an entire population, and not in the case where, oh, well, we'll give it a couple of times, a couple of years, it'll bounce back. It will never bounce back. It's gone. This is one of the things that happens out of ignorance, out of arrogance, out of assuming that we human beings are in charge of the nature of this planet and we can do whatever we like because we need the oil or the fish or the cattle or whatever it is. We're messing up this planet something fierce.
We were taught in geography class that there are disparate oceans on our planet, but in fact they're all connected. They flow into and out of one another on a course of, say, 1,200 years one way. And a drop of rain that falls in the North Atlantic will eventually circle Antarctica and emerge in the North Pacific. This connects all the oceans of the world, and it affects climate. And we know that in times past in Earth's history, the ocean conveyor belt has shut down, and there have been radical climate changes across the planet, including some of the glaciations and things like that that have taken place during times when the ocean conveyor belt was not flowing. There's changes in ocean chemistry, and ocean chemistry is affected by temperature and salinity primarily. So if you change either or both of those, you're likely to affect the flow of the ocean conveyor belt. As we know right now, we are affecting temperature. We do have global warming underway, and it has warmed the ocean significantly in the last 40 years. As the ocean warms, it's melting icy areas, the Arctic and the Antarctic, and these are adding a lot more fresh water into the oceans, and that's changing the salinity of the ocean. And as we change one parameter of temperature, we are also changing the chemistry of the ocean, and that in itself is a very dangerous development. And some of the studies right now are showing that as global warming increases and greenhouse gases increase, we're changing the acidity of the ocean. This acidity affects the ability of, for instance, seashells to make their shells. And for all the planktonic animals, which are most of the big fish in the sea when they're in their tiny little larval stages, it affects those animals' ability to make their bony structures. And some studies have shown that by the year 2100, the acidity of the oceans will prevent those animals from making shells and bones. We've seen extinction, big extinction events in Earth's history in the past, and many scientists today will admit and agree that we're coming up upon one of those. We have all the parameters, they're happening very, very quickly. And the ground zero for this extinction event may very well be in the world ocean. For instance, the worst extinction in Earth's history was the Permian-Triassic boundary, not when the dinosaurs died off, but way before that, 251 million years ago. And among other things, we know that the ocean conveyor belt system stopped running. We know that most of the ocean became a dead zone. This led to nearly the extinction of all life on Earth. 95% of marine species were killed, 70% of of land species were killed, and essentially mushrooms ruled the globe for many an eon. And that's basically something we could be looking at with the similar kinds of assaults that we're loading onto the planet right now. You know, there could be another event, but it might, in all honesty, be, you know, 600 million years in the future when we probably aren't going to be what we are now anyway. We'll be off in some other solar system, most likely. But the truth is, what's happening now is being caused by us. It's also happening at what we believe is an unprecedented rate in the history of natural change on the planet. So things are happening faster. Yes, we have historical models we can look at, and we can say, yeah, this resembles something that happened many hundreds of millions of years ago. Before, for instance, has science focused so intensively on one direction, and that is the changes that are going on our planet today as a result of human activity. We now know more about the life support system of our planet than we've ever known. We know what's wrong, and we know what to do, and what we still have to prove is that we have the political will to do it. Industrialized fisheries, which is what it is today, are stripping the oceans bare. And sadly, for all the target fish we might be going after, tuna or swordfish, we're collecting literally millions of tons per year of fish that we don't want, don't eat, and yet we kill in these industrialized fisheries. These are enormous nets, up to 160 miles long. These are fishing lines baited with up to 11,000 hooks. These are terribly indiscriminate technologies that we're using, and we would never do this in this day and age on the land, but we go ahead and do it in the ocean because no one can really see. Many of the drift nets are lost at sea or abandoned at sea in bad weather, and they are set frequently very deep, maybe 1,000 feet deep, and they're just drifting down there for years or perhaps decades, and they continue to catch fish, and the fish that get caught in it die and decay and attract more predators who come in and get caught, and these things can fish with, as I said, nightmarish efficiency for years. It's a very indiscriminate form of fishing, and along with your target species, whatever that may be, you know, these fisheries catch hundreds of thousands of turtles and seabirds and millions of sharks per year. And these animals are usually dead because many of them are air breathing, or like sharks, they need to move to breathe, and when they come to a stop, they die in these nets. It's estimated that as much as 25% of the total world fish catch is what's called bycatch, which is fish that is inadvertently caught and is killed and just thrown overboard, either dead or dying. That adds up to somewhere in the neighborhood of 88 billion pounds of life a year. Now, if we were to do anything on that scale on Earth, you can bet there'd be a huge outcry. Let's say you were going to hunt lions. You were going to be selling lion meat in the grocery store, and in order to catch lions, you were killing antelope and wildebeest and elephants and every other thing that lived on the African savanna to get at it. There'd be a huge outcry about this, but we do this routinely in the ocean. Until now, fisheries managers have used what's called a single species approach, where they've just attempted to manage one species. And we talked about things being interconnected. The oceans are too interconnected. You can't just manage one species. You really need to look at the bigger picture. And so what some people are now advocating is that we do ecosystem-based management rather than single species management. It's hard to get these managers, who are usually government employees, to go along with this. It's a shift in thinking. Maybe the younger generation will start to make it, but right now it's not really happening. In many cases, it entails at least some period of time of creating a marine reserve. It's certain core areas where maybe no fishing is allowed for a certain period of years, knowing that as you protect the core, it all will fan outward with healthier fish on the perimeter. And after time, you may even be allowed to allow fishing back in, although you may always protect a key core area. So it will start to look more like that. Another key shift that's underway in the thinking right now is towards what fish do we catch. And in the past, fisheries managers have thought that in helping to save fish populations, we would just catch the big old fish. And in fact, fisheries scientists are now seeing that what they call the big old fat female fish, or the box, are the most valuable members of a fish society. They make more eggs and they make better quality eggs than younger females. And these are the last fish we should be targeting to catch. We should be allowing the big old fat female fish to live out their lives happily and never catch them. In fact, we should be targeting younger females who have already reached sexual maturity, at least some of them. This is an outgrowth of the green revolution. And ever since we made the land so green, we've ironically been killing off the ocean. The same fertilizers that make plants grow on land also make them grow in the sea, and too many plants in the sea is a very bad thing. And what happens is as these plants grow and die, they feed decomposers who then use up all the oxygen in the water. And there are literally places, usually at the mouths of big river systems, where the water does not contain enough oxygen to support marine life. They become more or less completely empty of life. Breadbasket of the United States, and yes, the study showed about 14% reduction in fertilizer use would significantly decrease the dead zone at the mouth of the Mississippi River. However, you've got something on the order of 30 states that are part of the breadbasket, and they all need to create laws to control fertilizer use. You can imagine how hard it is to get one state to go along with these kinds of laws, yet 30 states, some of whom are hundreds of miles from the ocean, to agree to change their practices for something they never even see, and you can see how difficult this might be. Europe has some very bad dead zones. The Baltic Sea is one of the worst out there. It's a persistent dead zone. It's year-round, and it's about the size of South Carolina now. And not all of these are caused by agricultural runoff from the land. Some of them, for instance, the Chesapeake Bay and Long Island Sound here in the United States, are caused by airborne emissions from coal, burning plants, and things like that. Let me know what the efforts to regulate them have been like, right? We've lost ground after we are seeing definite melting of the Arctic. The summertime ice is, with each of the last 4 years, it's been the smallest amount of summertime ice in the Arctic, with each year clumping the previous year. 2005 overall was the warmest year on record that we know of on the planet. And now we're beginning to see that even the wintertime ice accumulation in the Arctic is not growing as big as it used to. And all of this has many effects. It's going to raise sea levels worldwide. It's already happening. Some people are raising questions of what's the point of fixing New Orleans, when we're just going to be raising sea levels up anyway, and they're going to be so subject to flooding, as will many of our great cities. So we have sea level rise, we also have changes in salinity now. We're freshening the ocean. It's less salt if we put all this dissolved fresh water into it. That again changes the chemistry of the ocean. The chemistry of the ocean changes currents. We're back to the ocean conveyor belt. And now we have a change in the whole weather pattern of the planet as we change the ocean conveyor belt. And right now, the U.S. and Canada, normally we're quite good friendly neighbors, are having a major dispute over the rights to Arctic boundary waters and who really owns these pieces of land. Because the Northwest Passage is scheduled to open, the fabled Northwest Passage, which no one could ever find, will be opening up, most people believe, within the next 20 to 30 years. And whoever has the shipping rights to that is going to make a lot of money. So there's a huge land grab going on right now in the Arctic. Sadly, it doesn't bode well for things like polar bears who depend on sea ice. And we're looking at the potential extinction of polar bears and some of their prey, like harp seals, which den on sea ice. Polar bears are now considered one of the one or two most polluted animals on Earth, along with killer whales up in the Norwegian fjords. And these animals, in many cases after death, they are so loaded with toxins that they are classified as toxic waste. As we can see, we have a very scattershot approach right now. There are some nations and countries that are willing to examine these issues, and then we have the United States. Our government currently says that these aren't even real issues. They're using the little bit of normal variation that exists within science to say, well, let's just not look at any of this, when in fact, overwhelmingly, the scientists of the world have agreed that global climate change is an enormous problem that we need to tackle, and yet the United States, the biggest greenhouse gas polluter, has yet to get on board these efforts.
As you can see, die-off under the market order is in full effect. And whether mushrooms will rule the oceans once again with species die-off, or whether there will be a mushroom cloud ruling the planet in its imperial nuclear waste of humanity, both lead to the same cause. The monopolistic capital market force and the elite order that engineers it, and those who serve it. It's time that the slaves, both human and fish, prepare for a real shark attack against one's enemy. Until the next time. Slave out.